You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast. Sports podcast. Podcast about sports. Podcast about the week in sports. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across this oval table, the one, the only, the legend, the myth, Neil Payne, 538 sports writer. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad. How are you?
I'm good, Neil. I'm feeling all business today.
I don't know if you've gotten that from my demeanor. Well, told me to stop making you laugh.
Yeah, I'm a businessman. Kate Fagan on the other side of the country, ESPN W columnist. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Kate. How are you?
I'm good.
Kate,
you were so amazing in our live performance, weren't we?
I know. I feel actually it feels wrong to be in the studio now instead of in front of adoring hundreds.
We had to lock them out. Didn't you see them lined up?
Oh, yeah. No, they had like signs. It was a little bit like a Trump rally out there, though, so I was a little worried for people's safety.
You didn't want to incite anything.
We're a big deal.
Exactly. So we should note that at that live show, which if you missed it last week, we recorded at MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference on Friday. I think it was in your Hot Takedown feeds on Saturday.
Otherwise, I can't imagine people are thinking, what the hell are we talking about?
So if you missed that, check it out. We talked to Shane Battier, Daryl Morey, and each other. But we also, most importantly, wore T-shirts during that live show. They are, I would say, what, a cerulean blue, guys? An aquamarine blue? How would you characterize that color?
I think azure.
Azure blue?
Maybe a royal blue?
A royal blue. I think there was a hint of green in there, Kate. A royal blue-green. And the point of why I bring this up is because, listeners, we want to give T-shirts to you. And we debated about how to do that best. We didn't. Again, we have masses massed outside of our door. We couldn't just throw them out. They're limited edition. And so
do we have that T-shirt cannon that we talked about?
We haven't sprung for it quite yet. I should note that on the T-shirts is a picture of Adam Silver riding a bear into a pool full of fish. Longtime Hot Takedown listeners, Hot Takedown diehards, thank you for listening, first of all. Second of all, you may remember that you fixed the NBA draft lottery, and one of your ideas, which was not the winner, unfortunately, but one of your ideas was for Adam Silver to ride a bear into a pool of fish, and the fish, each fish would have a team somehow branded onto it, and that fish, whichever fish the bear selected, would be get the first pick in the draft. These T-shirts have that image on it. It's a magnificent image. We want to give you this T-shirt. Hot Takedown listeners, here's how to win the T-shirt. Join our March Madness Bracket Challenge. Go to 538.com, find the Hot Takedown article page that has this podcast in it, and join our brackets. We're going to give away four T-shirts for the best and worst entrance in both the men's and women's tournament. So you can game this both ways. It's like playing high-low in poker. You can either go for glory or try and pick every underdog, for example, and see if that can win you the T-shirt.
I feel that would be easier to do to game the low end in the women's bracket.
You think so, but you also have to game one another, right? Like it's a game theory thing. You have to be wrong in a different way than other people are wrong. I think, should we stipulate that ties don't count on the low end? Because there could be 80 people tied because they just picked every lower seed to win.
Do you think they'd do that?
Our listeners?
No, there's often a 5-12 in women's basketball. Like Marist has won. So there's like just enough upsets that I think it'd be tricky.
All right.
Perhaps.
So if there's a tie for more than two or three, then unfortunately I don't think we have enough T-shirts to go around. Essentially our message is don't tank the bracket. The T-shirts, after all, are all about fixing tanking in the NBA. That'd be a
cruel irony.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so on today's show, and sorry, one more time, listeners, 538.com. go find Hot Takedown and join our ESPN group, our tournament challenge bracket group.
I just submitted my picks on the men's side.
Excellent.
So take down my
overachiever, Neil.
March Mathness.
Hey.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Okay. You should be happy you're not in the studio to see Neil's face as he made that pun.
I can't even take credit for it. Someone else made it up in the office the other day.
So on today's show, it is all NCAA all the time. In some ways, we don't even need the billboard. I think we can just get right into it. Billboard is, you know, podcast speak for what comes at the beginning, where I tell you what's on the show.
You slinging that lingo.
So let's begin with the men. We're going to talk men's and women's, and then we're also going to have a little listener mail at the end. I think Joe Sykes is going to join us for that, our producer. So let's get right to the men's bracket. Every year, 538 does a probabilistic bracket that shows the probability of each game, as well as the probability of each team winning, going to a certain stage in the tournament. This year, a new feature that's added that I'm really excited about is that we're going to have live in-game win probabilities. So if Kansas is losing when the second half starts, you'll see the chance that they're actually going to lose the game, weighted to the fact that they're losing to a 16 seed, where, you know, it's less likely that they're going to lose in the end. Anyway, so Kansas is the number one team in our tournament, 19%, though not far ahead of other teams. North Carolina is at 15%, Michigan State 9%, and Oklahoma 7%. That's the final four, according to the probabilistic bracket. But 19% for Kansas. Neil, does that strike you as high as just about right?
It seems a little bit low. In the past, the favorite has had about a 20 to 25% chance when we've kind of run the numbers like this. Of course, last year, Kentucky had a 41% chance going into the tournament, and that was sort of an abnormally high year. I'd say this one is slightly low, but not abnormally so. Louisville, when we ran this 2 years ago, was the favorite with a 15% chance. So maybe not as low as we would have thought the number would have been before Kansas started playing super awesome basketball down the stretch. And we talked, I think, about a month ago about how this year was just totally devoid of dominance, and then Kansas kind of turned it on at the end.
Yeah, it seemed like the storyline all year was that would have led me to believe that when 538 came out with the percentages, we'd have like 7 or 8 teams kind of in the maybe the 8 to 13% win chance range. It seems that even the discrepancy between 19% for Kansas and 14 for North Carolina is that 5 percentage points seems different than what I would have expected, given how all year long we're talking about how there's so much parity.
Yeah, and just, Kate, it's 19-15. I think I may have misspoke earlier, and so it's only 4 percentage points, which is even narrower. Neil, do 4 percentage points even matter? With this much, with so many variables going in and out, right, where you have to play 6 games to win, it seems like 4 percentage points it's basically a push,
a push, but yeah, it's such a small difference, and we're talking about teams that are pretty evenly matched with each other, that like it does make a difference. It does add up on a certain level, but you would have to play the tournament many, many times in many alternate universes in order for it to truly kind of compound upon itself and add up. And we only get to play one, and that's the beauty of March Madness. And so I would say if you add up the odds for the top four teams, it's 50%. So there's a 50-50 shot that, you know, the field versus the top four that we mentioned earlier in terms of probability of making the final four. And if you add up the odds for the top eight teams, it's 75%. So that seems kind of almost maybe close to ideal. Like, it's, you know, you're pretty sure that one of this kind of group of good teams will be the champion when it's all said and done, but we don't really know which of those good teams it will be. And then there's still an outside shot that some team from, you know, outside of that group makes it in, but it's not a very good chance. So I don't know, that feels kind of right, Kate? It's not like Kentucky steamrolling everyone.
No, yeah, I think, like, I was surprised that there was even that break between number one and number two, but when you see that you're actually adding up the top eight programs and coming to pretty much that you can select from that pool and you have the champion, that, considering the storylines all year, that feels more accurate. Although, Neil, I am still wondering, though, if you have like an outsider riding into your Final Four.
Yeah, my Final Four was Villanova, which is something of a...
Going down.
Yes. I have Villanova emerging, which I've just had a feeling. I know that under Jay Wright, they have not had the greatest track record.
Only a 22% chance of making the Final Four, but Neil says go for it.
I'm just going for it. Yeah. I would advise people listening to not do what
Neil,
I'm doing.
Neil, is this the first time you've ever said the words, I had a feeling on Hot Takedown?
Yeah, you know, it may have been.
That's not analytically supported. That's not how you should do things, Neil.
Right. Well, one of the things that I looked at, and if you go into Tournament Challenge, you can do this too at ESPN, is they offer kind of a breakdown from a bunch of different metric points of view. So they use the power ratings, which is a similar system to what we have. Then they also look for similar games to kind of the matchup at hand. They use a machine learning thing, which I was really impressed and surprised that they have that in, like a decision tree model. And that's something that there's a story up at 538 today about a lady that had never watched college basketball before and just decided spur of the moment to enter a competition, and she made her picks using this type of model and ended up winning the whole thing. So I don't know if that's an endorsement of it or not, but and then they have a few other things where they look at like this, you know, typical matchup between seedings and things like that.
So you're
and
saying so, even your feeling is based off of numbers.
No. My feeling is based on numbers, and so when I see a situation where maybe the decision tree model cuts a different way than maybe the power ratings. The decision tree is capable of seeing things, kind of deep relationships between numbers.
You could have just had a feeling. It would have been okay.
Oh, I'm never going to let it be that way.
We would have
you know there's a justification.
The feeling that you have.
You know there's a justification for all this in the numbers. So, yeah, Villanova, I think, had a little bit better odds. And the important thing also to think about, as I'm going off on my tangent here, is if you're competing in a big pool, hopefully this will be one because there's a bunch of people who are fond listeners and they'll all enter their picks, is that you want to do something that not everyone is doing. So perhaps by saying it on the air before everyone gets a chance to pick, I have destroyed that strategy. But it's often kind of counterintuitively not in your best interest to go chalk or go for, you know, if you live in Lexington, Kentucky, to pick Kentucky to win the championship. But anyway, just to run down the rest of mine, I had Villanova, Oklahoma, UNC, and Michigan State. Michigan State and Villanova. Yes, the 3-2 seeds, 1-1 seed. And this is an interesting fact that came out of our model was that in, I think, at least two of the regions, the 2 seed is actually favored to make it over the 1 seed. I think in the West with Oklahoma and in the Midwest with Michigan State. Mm-hmm. Is that right? And
yes.
Then I think UNC is our favorite in the
East.
And then Villanova or
Kansas
over Villanova.
You haven't memorized all the bracket names.
Yeah, well, you know, it's only been a couple.
So,
days.
So Kate, let's go ahead.
No, is that like the reason that number 2 is a favorite over number 1? Is that because that half of the bracket with the number 1 seed happens to be denser with more good teams, even if?
Yeah.
Obviously the ones. Okay.
I think that was the case, especially with Michigan State in the Midwest, because
they are a 1 seed.
They, first of all, a lot of people have been saying that they should be a 1 seed. Our power ratings agree. And I wonder if the committee was thinking about this or if it's just serendipitous, but the way in which they structured the rest of the bracket, so kind of like you hear about the pods, you know, the various different paths that teams have to the Final Four. Virginia's is tougher, and also Michigan State is playing. It's in Chicago, so they're playing closer, far closer than Virginia in the Elite Eight in the Final Four round or the Sweet 16 in the Elite Eight. So it almost worked out so that those things counterbalance the fact that Virginia, you know, is probably even with Michigan State on our numbers, and certainly the committee thought that they were a stronger team.
So Kate, I want to get to your Final Four in a second, but since Neil brought up the committee, I want to make sense. I want to hear from both of you guys about what the hot take of the week was, which is that the committee shunted mid-majors in favor of bigger conference teams, whether that feels like it bears out. I mean, Vanderbilt made it rather than Monmouth. Say Bonaventure didn't make it. And so I feel like some of these teams that had very good regular seasons and had some wins outside their conferences but did not win their conference tournament, the take of the week seemed to be that the committee was inconsistent about what they've said in the past, which was go outside your conference, play hard games, and then we'll let more of you mid-majors into the tournament.
Well, from a former athlete point of view and having sat through a bracket being delivered on TV in a team that you're playing, I always felt that if I saw us pitted against a major conference team as like an 8-9 game or something like that, that I would be more worried if it was a major conference bubble team that got in over a mid-major. So I'm not saying that that's not like empirical data, but I'm always confused by the argument that these mid-majors are actually better teams. I think mostly what's going into that is like in a lot of cases, it can be like an emotional attachment to having more underdogs in the bracket because it's more fun for everybody, and it's less fun to have like, you know, like a Florida State and like a Vanderbilt into the bracket as like, you know, mm-hmm. they're kind of like, they're the haves, not the have-nots. And so we don't seem to like that from an emotional point of view. But from like a basketball point of view, I would have much rather played a mid-major who snuck in as a bubble team.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Kate. Like, I think in some ways we sort of overvalue the mid-majors at times. And also there's almost like a, I don't want to say it's like a moral judgment, but sometimes it takes that tenor against teams that, you know, come from major conferences and maybe underachieve during the year or they don't win that many games. And we tend to kind of think like those teams have all the recruiting tools at their disposal. Mm-hmm. They should be way better than this. And the thing that we don't actually think about is they've also played a tougher schedule in a lot of cases. And if you look at like the KenPom ratings, a lot of the teams that people are talking about as being the bubble teams like Monmouth, St. Bonaventure, they actually were very low on the power ratings. And I should say Ken Pomeroy is a guy that does these power ratings for college basketball. We became fond of him last season and dropped his name quite a bit. I would imagine we're going to do the same over the next few weeks. But if he's also one of our metrics that the 538 model uses, I should also say. But like, you know, St. Mary's was a team that was on the bubble. They lost the West Coast Conference championship. They're a team that probably did deserve to get in. And I feel like the outrage for them didn't seem to be on the same level as some of the other teams that got mentioned. Valpo out of the Horizon League was actually the 36th best team in the country, according to KenPom. I didn't hear a whole lot of complaints about Valpo not making it in as an at-large bid. So it seems like the teams that we focus on are not always consistent with the teams that perhaps played the best, and it kind of goes to what the committee, you know, the committee didn't do a great job this year. I think everyone kind of acknowledges that. But at the same time, they do try to use some version of an objective methodology, even if it is the kind of archaic RPI, to try to balance things like conference strength, strength of schedule, things like that. And we can take issue with what they do, but I think a lot of the criticism doesn't even go that far. They just kind of look at the names on the teams and the win-loss record.
So, Kate, let's return to our Final Four picks now. Who you got?
Well, I obviously have two brackets, Chad, because I've got the one bracket with Colorado winning.
Oh, I thought I was going to say.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was a Duke.
Shane Battier told us.
I mean, I know Shane Battier plays it that way, but because my alma mater is Colorado, I got to go with Colorado. And I was disappointed to see that they have a 0% chance of winning the whole tournament.
I think it's a less than
it's
11%
less than 0.1%. We can't say anything has a 0% chance, so we truncate it.
No, I know, but I guess the way that it looks in the chart, because they don't have, you know, two decimal places, is 0.0. So that's really sad for a Colorado fan.
You know, that we were going to have it say 0.1, but we said, you know, Kate Fagan's going to be looking at that. Let's just take it down one notch.
Well, yeah.
Glad you noticed. Yeah.
It hurt. So I got that one bracket. I got the one bracket with Colorado winning. And then my second bracket, I actually just filed one for Around the Horn, and I will file it also the Hot Takedown. I just realized I seem to approach it differently because I don't think that I approach, this is going to sound odd, I don't think I approach these pools to win them. I think I approach to, like, be in, like, the top 20%.
Oh, interesting.
Because I don't...
Risk aversion.
I don't ever try and do things differently to make sure mm-hmm. that I can set myself apart. I usually try and pick a couple upsets, a couple teams that I've seen play and all of a sudden have, like, you know, somehow found a place in my heart. And then I usually have a Final Four with, like, 1-2, sometimes a 3. But I'm usually like, hey, if I end up scoring, like, a B on this, that's going to be exciting.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
So I well, it depends what the what your end game is, right? Do you want to like feel? Do you want to be engaged all the way through? Because I think if you go try and go big, you could easily, you know, crap out in the first weekend or the first week and a half, and all of a sudden it's no fun anymore, right? There's no bracket to look at, basically.
Right. Yeah, I think mostly it's like if I'm competing with like 20 other around the horn people, I want to finish in the top 8.
Yeah.
So nobody's like, oh my God, Kate doesn't know what she's doing, and because I can't finish last.
You've got a rep to protect.
Take a risk-averse approach.
Yeah, I get it. All right, so both of you, sorry, Kate.
Did she say
you
have, final
yeah,
four?
You haven't said your final yeah. four. You, so much, yeah, equipment, so, so have, much, so have, much preamble, Kate. You know, let's get to the,
no,
get to
I,
the
well,
good stuff.
I just wanted to let you know that I was just realizing that I don't play to win.
Do you think that says something louder about your personality, Kate?
No, because that's actually the opposite of normal.
Oh, okay.
That's I'm going to have to psychoanalyze yeah. this after the podcast. But I have Kansas, Oklahoma on one side of the bracket, and then UNC, Michigan State on the other. I have Kansas, Carolina in the final, and then Kansas winning.
So boring, guys. You guys are
I
so
know.
Boring.
Why was mine boring? I had three two seeds.
Three
the
two seeds
are a good sweet spot
on,
to
you didn't
be
have an 11.
In,
you didn't let, have 11 seeds.
Let,
you
let me
like
tell you.
Nine.
You know,
what did you do? Wichita State?
Listen,
and
as someone who proudly watches about 3 weeks of college basketball leading up to the tournament, that's
literally
how I base
the 3
my,
weeks starting
yes,
like
that's
3 weeks
how I base
ago.
My entire approach to tournament things. And it's provisional. I my bracket isn't totally set, but this is where I'm leaning so far. So
and you make trips. You make scouting trips.
I make
too.
Scouting trips. I saw Villanova and St. Joe's in person.
You're
going to
see
year.
One of the Final Four then.
So
it's St. Joe's.
I think Kansas Villanova are going to have a weird 3-point off basically in the South Final, and I choose Villanova. I think I have had a friend, a big time Kansas booster friend, who was so down on this team midseason, and I do not believe this little resurgence at the end here. I think it's Big 12, 12-year streak is remarkable, but who is its competition really in the end? Oklahoma seems hollow. Anyway, so Villanova coming out of the South. Out of the West, I have Oregon going. I think it's East Coast bias. That's
Oregon.
The only reason that we do not believe in
oh,
Oregon.
Oh, are you kidding
I think
me?
The numbers are East Coast biased.
The numbers say they deserved a 3 seed. Come
yes.
on, Chad.
Moving along. In the Midwest, Michigan State, boring. And in the East, Indiana.
Oh, I could see that.
That's my somewhat sleeper.
I could
sleeper.
See that.
I think UNC's doesn't have it. I think Bryce Johnson can disappear for stretches of the game, and Marcus Page can go cold from the field. And so, you know, this is again based
you,
off the
Chad.
One
Look
game I watched of them play in Virginia against
Dropping
Virginia
knowledge.
In the ACC final. So that's my provisional Final Four. Again, listeners, go to 538.com, find this page. There will be find the Hot Takedown page. There will be links to our ESPN Tournament Challenge bracket. You can probably search for Hot Takedown inside ESPN Tournament Challenge. As well, I believe that's what the official corporate branding is. Sorry, ESPN Minders, if it's not. And then also on 538, you'll see all sorts of other coverage. Neil broke down why Purdue might be a good sleeper.
A dark horse
even. And we'll have rolling coverage for the next 3+ weeks. So be sure to go and check it out. Let's move on to the women's bracket now, where deja vu, more or less. UConn. We've talked about them several times this season, and the models show why. They have a 70% chance of winning the tournament. That, rather remarkably, is lower than last year when they had a 74% chance of winning the tournament.
You know, it was so the last year was the first time that we ever did a women's model. And that number was so eye-catching that we actually had to kind of sanity check it with like an alternative methodology. Like Nate slacks me, you know, the night of the selection or something. It's like, does this look right to you? This looks pretty high, but it checked out, and it, obviously it worked out.
So, yeah.
What was it last year again? Remind me.
74, and this year's it's 70. Kate,
got it.
In your gut, like, do you just think it's 99?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more than 99.9, only because the only thing I've seen in the women's game that relates to a potential UConn upset is in 2013 when Louisville beat Brittany Griner and Odyssey Sims' Baylor team. And I wish that 538 had the percentage model well, I wish 538 had existed then and they would have had the percentage model, because I have to imagine that Baylor was probably upwards of like 50 or 60% to win that year.
Because that's, yeah.
Considering they had gone undefeated the previous year and they had like lost early in the season that year. And then they just got, I mean, Louisville shot insane. So I guess the only thing I could see happening is if a team like Notre Dame swooped in and had an absurd shooting night, like made 18-plus threes. That's really the only way.
That's the thing. I mean, we talked last year about Kentucky and their ability to go undefeated in the men's game, and we also spoke about UConn's ability to go undefeated in the women's game. It seems as though, you know, UConn, I mean, their margin of victory this year was something like 34, 37 points, I think, something crazy.
Yeah.
Their average margin of victory. And so even a hot shooting night is hard to make up a 37-point average margin of victory, you know? I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, and going back to that 2012 Brittany Griner team, from when we've talked about UConn so far this season, I have some numbers from the past few years. And so we have this power rating. It's based on Jeff Sagarin's ratings. He's a guy that crunches numbers a bit like Ken Pom. And Baylor that year, it's theoretically on a 0 to 100 scale, but some of these women's teams are so good that they sort of exceed it. Baylor that year was a 112. And by comparison, this year's UConn team is a 116. So, but the difference within the year also, just speaking to the odds of winning compared to the competition, that year, Baylor was about 5 points better than the second-best team, which was Notre Dame and UConn. Those two were kind of tied for second almost. This year, UConn is about 15.5 points better than the next-best team, which is Baylor, and 15 points over Notre Dame. So Baylor and Notre Dame are pretty much in a dead heat for second, so, and I believe that's what our model has also.
So, as I said, this year, UConn's a little less favored than they were last year at 70%. Rather than 74, and I asked Jay Boyce, who does our modeling for our tournament brackets, and about why, you know, those 4 percentage points had sort of evaporated, and he said that this year there's a little more parity in the top echelon of teams. There are 4 teams that have more than 10% chance of being Connecticut, while last year there were only 2 that Connecticut could meet along the way.
I like that the cutoff, the right. Baseline is 10%, just to be in the same neighborhood so that UConn doesn't have greater than a 90% chance of beating you is considered like a huge development. We've doubled the number of teams that UConn is not supposed to beat more than 90% of the time.
Yeah, so, you know, Kate, if UConn were to get beat, I mean, I know that you think they're not going to, but if they were to get beat, where do you see it coming? Is it Notre Dame?
That's the only team I can see beating UConn, and it might be the only team I can see beating UConn because it's the only team I've ever really seen beat UConn, right? Like in
this iteration,
yeah.
And we should say that Notre Dame is especially talented in their backcourt, right?
Right. And it seems like the only way you're not going to have a situation where UConn wildly underperforms, I don't think, right? Like, because they just play so hard that maybe they have a poor shooting night, but you're not going to have one of those nights where we've seen from Baylor in the past or in the postseason where all of a sudden you're like, oh, Baylor didn't show up to play. That's not going to happen with UConn because of the historical nature in which he coaches that program and the players within that program pass along a sense of work ethic from generation to generation, right? So the only way that I can see UConn losing is if there's a statistical anomaly, and the only team I think is capable of that is Notre Dame, because you mentioned the backcourt and because that was the only time all year that I even saw UConn sweating was when Notre Dame shot the ball from distance really, really well.
Yeah, we should say that Notre Dame is on the opposite side of the bracket of UConn. And so the way things that are structured, you know, the number 2 seed in their region is Texas. And Texas would be about a 24-point underdog against UConn. This is the second best team in the same region. So it's almost inconceivable that even if UConn, if you could fast forward into the future and someone told you UConn did lose, that if you had to guess when it would happen, it almost certainly wouldn't happen before the Final Four or the championship game, just because the way in which the distribution of talent is in women's basketball, all of those teams that have the 10% or less chance of beating them are scattered across the various regions, and then they won't have to face them for a long time.
And this gets at what Kay was saying about what if someone has a hot shooting night, is that enough to take down UConn? I think to our political polling model that's on 538 a bit, and it shows you sort of the distribution of possible results for each candidate, right? So in we're recording this right before the primaries on Tuesday the 15th, and so in Ohio, for example, Kasich and Trump basically had the same distribution curve, right? And so that's why it's 50-50, because they could end up anywhere on there, and
the other one could end up anywhere on
exactly.
there, and it's all about the overlap
right.
in which
exactly.
they yeah.
So for a state in which maybe this is the case in Florida, where Trump is vastly favored over Marco Rubio, you see that just the forward tail of Marco Rubio's distribution curve overlaps with the back tail of Trump's possible vote in Florida. And so that's what it would take. And so for UConn, when we say that UConn has a 99% chance of winning a game, that's because the two tails, they never overlap,
right.
essentially. But these teams that have a 10% chance, it's just where those tails begin
it's
to overlap.
That the
upset would happen, which would be UConn having an awful night and someone like Notre Dame having a great night. Because just Notre Dame having a great night isn't enough to catch up with the middle of UConn's distribution or the far end.
Right, yeah. And the in on the men's side in college basketball, at least, there's been some research showing that when you make a prediction like the kind that we're doing with these power ratings that generate the predictions for our brackets, there is this distribution curve that's centered around that prediction. And there's, of course, you know, a history of the variance around it. And when you look at that, it looks like a bell curve. The standard deviation is 10 points. So, one standard deviation means that it could be off by plus 10 or minus 10 based on what we consider the middle of the projection to be. And in the case of, Texas being a 24-point underdog against UConn, it would take a greater than 2.4 standard deviation event for Texas to break even against UConn. And that helps to explain why, like, it's so far out on the edge of the probability curve that even the second best team being a 16-point underdog, still 1.6 standard deviations from the norm just to have them catch UConn. And maybe that looks like they force overtime against UConn, since these are based on in the course of regulation play. So, yeah, that goes to show why it's just so unlikely that a team could actually beat a team like UConn that's so far ahead of everyone else.
So, Kate, when you were Colorado playing college basketball for them, you were seeded 6th, 3rd, 6th, and 6th. I think the furthest you made, according to my little research pack, is the Elite Eight. Is that right, Kate?
That's correct.
Okay. And so, did you come across UConn along that journey? And if so, how did that, play in your mind?
Yeah, my senior year, when we were seeded 6th, we had to go play Santa Barbara at Santa Barbara, and Santa Barbara was seated 11th, but it was on their home court. So we kind of, that was one of those years in seedings where even though we were 6th, it seemed like we had a good pairing because it was a mid-major that we were going to play. And we had the regional that we were set up in had UConn. And that, in women's basketball, and this happened every year, I think that was the only year we were in the same bracket as UConn, but it was, I remember even talking to my teammates, we were like, well, if we can get to the Sweet 16, that'll be a good year. Like, there was no inkling in any of our minds that our season was going to last longer than that regional in Connecticut, because of course all those regionals they keep UConn as close to Connecticut as they can. Usually they're playing on campus, and then they're playing in like Bridgeport, or they're playing in Hartford. Like, they're always playing somewhere right around, because they draw so many fans. So I remember distinctly watching the Selection Monday show and us being like, okay, if we beat Santa Barbara, right, and then if we beat TCU, well, then we'll lose to UConn, but that will have been a great year. Like, and we were competitive people, and we had, like, worked really hard, but we were also realistic human beings, and we were like, there's no way that we can win at UConn.
Yeah.
And I can't even imagine for these teams now, because even then there was a little bit more parity. Mm-hmm. Like, UConn was good, but they weren't totally what they are now in terms of the separation between them and some of the other teams. Like, at least then it was like Tennessee was like always on par. Baylor was really good then still too. So it wasn't even the separation that UConn has now, and it was still a mental defeat before we even got three games away from them.
Yeah, I mean, we should note that the home court rules in college basketball women's college basketball are probably healthier for the women's game economically, at least in the short term, because there are these essential home games, or these games that are tantamount to home games, that are played. But it creates these very weird situations where, for example, Kentucky's team this year is going to play in Rupp Arena, I believe, in Sweet 16 and the Elite Eight, which is essentially their home arena, which you're not supposed to be able to do if you play in it more than three times during the season. Kentucky's women's team only played in it twice. So all of a sudden now it gets all the creature comforts of a full actual home game, not just a game near Lexington. There are incentives and rule sets that I think are strange, not just because they aren't the men's game, but because they create strange reactions to how teams schedule their games and try and win the tournament.
Yeah, one year we were a six seed, but we had already gotten the hosting. Like, they were predetermined sites, and we were a host. And North Carolina came in as a three seed, and we beat them. And their coach, Sylvia Hatchell, and they were furious, because they just think that within the NCAA and that system and that setup and having games on people's campuses render however good you played in the regular season useless. Hmm. And it just became, especially when you add in altitude, I guess, if you're coming to Boulder, but you kind of go back and forth in the women's game because you don't want to create this built-in unfair advantage. But one, as a student athlete, you don't want to play in front of nobody. And two, it already loses the most money of any NCAA championship, the women's basketball tournament. And so they're kind of caught having to, if they can put a couple thousand more fans into the seat, they have to do it.
All right, Neil, you're the Final Four on the women's side.
This is going to be really depressing, especially since you seemed very upset that I even picked two seeds on the men's side. But I think you almost have no choice but to go chalk. If you think about, just according to the power ratings, the one that we've been updating during the season when we've talked about women's basketball, there are really, like, there's a group of five teams, UConn, Notre Dame, Baylor, Maryland, and South Carolina, that are clearly separated from the next kind of group of teams. Unfortunately, you can't have a final five, and Maryland was actually a two seed in the Lexington bracket, and that's the same bracket that contains Notre Dame. So we right now have Notre Dame as a 53% favorite to make the Final Four. Out of that, we have Maryland as a 32% favorite. And Maryland just has a tougher path. They have to face Kentucky, who is in the next tier of teams along the way. Notre Dame seems to have a much easier path to the Final Four. And so that's the only one where it's really even kind of close to thinking about, maybe who should I go? Who else is, who else good is in the bracket? So I think you have to go chalk, and then from there, it does seem like UConn has an overwhelming advantage over anyone that they would play. In this case, it would be Baylor from the Dallas region. And then on the other side, South Carolina and Notre Dame is interesting to me. I think that Notre Dame is better, but we have South Carolina being, relatively close to them based on the way that they played. And it could be fun to have a team, other than another, something other than UConn and Notre Dame in the final. But I'm going to go with Notre Dame again, and I'm going to go with the UConn. Very boring, very chalky, but
we should note real quick that last year our women's bracket actually overthought some things, and if you had just gone with chalk, you would have outperformed the picks, quote unquote, that we made in our women's bracket. So
is that the final four or throughout
the full bracket? Yeah, that includes round 64. All right, Kate, what are you thinking? Other than UConn
winning? Well, if I was in studio, I would be giving Neil a fist bump right now because we have the same exact Final Four.
I think a lot of people are going to have that.
And I think, though, I will say, like, the South Carolina and how they've become an elite program, with hiring Dawn Staley and then building that program, like that should be adding this new dimension to women's college basketball, because for so long it was just the old standards. But what you need to see happen, because what we need to see happen is Tennessee resurrect their program again, because I love the development of South Carolina out of the SEC conference, but the fact that Tennessee has dropped off so much, it's almost like South Carolina has replaced Tennessee instead of introducing a new dominant program.
Now, it should be said, Kentucky is a lot better than they have been in the past.
Yeah, and Baylor, if you went back 10 years, they were awful. So Baylor became an elite program. If you could keep Tennessee producing at the level it had produced for the last 20 years, you would have a little bit more parity in women's college basketball, especially because of the way South Carolina has come up and developed the program out of nowhere. But then you've got this ebb and flow. So I don't have South Carolina. I think that they're still about 2 years away from like breaking through and getting to the national title game and competing to win it. But of course, that's going to depend on like if UConn already has the next Breanna Stewart too.
We're all in agreement, guys. I mean, I can't choose anything but what you've already said. It just seems foolhardy. And I also, unfortunately, don't watch enough women's college basketball during the regular season. I feel like I really only tune in during the tournament, so I don't even have my total small sample size hunches to go by. So I will trust the numbers, lacking other information that clearly is more savvy than the numbers. All right, so listeners, once again, join our brackets. You can find the link online and search for Hot Takedown in the ESPN Tournament Challenge, and free t-shirts for all. And by that I mean four people. All right, now instead of Sig Dig, we're going to do a bit of listener mail. Kate Fagan had to jump out to catch a plane.
She sends her regards.
And so instead, we released him from the cage. He is barreled in like a British rugby player.
All right, Chad. All right.
It's Joe Sykes, our producer, Joe Sykes. Welcome, Joe. Thanks for cutting me off at the opportune moment. That's what a producer does.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
You have a good sense for timing. Joe, what kind of reader mail have you brought us today?
So a couple of weeks ago, we had a segment on the show about how to fix the three-point shot problem. Whether it is a problem is debatable, but Mark Cuban thinks it is. And we got a lot of listener mail from y'all. I have picked out a few of them, and I'm going to put them to Neil and Chad and see what they think. So our first email is from Colin Rumel. Sorry, Colin, if I've butchered your name there. He says, "Dear Chad, Neil, and Kate, an obvious way to decrease the relative effect of a three-point shot would be to make twos worth threes and make threes worth four.
Interesting. What about free throws?
Well, he's got an answer for that. So he says, give fouled players a single one-point shot and the ball back with half a shot clock. That this would increase the penalty against fouling by the current rules. Neil, is he right?
Well, so based on the numbers that I've looked at right now, it is kind of imbalanced. The imbalance is actually between field goals and free throws. That if you look at the points per possession of a two-pointer, it's about 0.98 so far this season. Points per possession for a three-pointer is 1.06. That's pretty close to each other. Points per possession for a free throw is 1.7.
That's for
points per possession.
Set of free throws?
It's per, yes, exactly, for a set of or the number of possessions, I guess, that free throws use. And we should say one of the things that basketball metrics people came up with long ago is that each free throw doesn't take up a whole possession or half a possession, even though you think of two shots from a foul. Sometimes you get more than two shots for a foul, and so it uses up only about two-fifths of a possession. So that's what that's based on. Under this scheme, it would increase the relative value of field goals, and it actually would make two-pointers more valuable than three-pointers. So the desired effect would happen.
By which you mean three-pointers more valuable than four-pointers.
Yes, exactly, okay. To make things maximally confusing. So the old two-pointers, now three-pointers, would be worth 1.5 points per possession. The old three-pointers, which are now four-pointers, would be worth 1.4 points per possession.
So it's a good idea because it achieves the
mid-range
shooting becomes
well,
more
so
valuable.
With layups. I mean, it's not just right. mid-range shooting, but two-pointers in general are more valuable.
Right, exactly. Now, of course, if you take away the one free throw give you the half a shot clock, it's pretty tough to say what that would do to the efficiency of free throws. But at the very least, this has brought the efficiency of field goals, shots from the field, up toward the level, not quite to that 1.7 mark, but toward the level of per possession value that they should be targeting.
So which one of us should make the call to Adam Silver?
We have the number. Chad? We owe him a t-shirt.
Okay.
We have a t-shirt for you, Adam.
Can we put this on a t-shirt too? This seems pretty complicated to put on a t-shirt.
One of our visuals people might be able to. Yeah. Maybe Allison McCann
well, oh my God. Antoine Walker said one time when they asked him, why do you take so many threes? He said, because they don't have fours. Now they would have fours.
Colin, Antoine it's a great Walker. Idea. I'm going to come at you with one more idea. And I think this is my favorite because it's simple and I think it would be make the game a lot more fun. Hi guys, says Steve Croner. Reward strong inside plays by giving 3 points for slam dunks.
Incentivize the slam dunk even more.
It's brilliant.
Why is it brilliant, Joe?
3-point shot, slam dunks. That's all people really want to see.
It's just a highlight reel NBA.
That's all people really want to see.
Doesn't that make things worse based on the criticisms of
the
NBA
being nothing?
It's
like eating candy all the time.
Everyone goes for 3 points.
No, you need something baseline boring in order to make those things that happen even more special and rare.
This is the game I want to see. This is the game I want to see.
I have the sport for you.
Brit.
Have you heard of slam ball, Joe?
Oh, my God. Slam ball.
Neil, when are we doing analytics of slam ball?
Oh, tomorrow? Today? This
Joe,
afternoon?
Joe, this is a sport in which people are on trampolines.
Grown men.
And they defend each other in midair. And they are leaping higher than you can imagine, and their knees are blowing out more often than you can imagine.
Oh, do we have injury? I mean, when I was young and watching this on Spike TV as a youth, first of all, I was watching Spike TV, which is weird, and then also I didn't think about the injuries and the implications of it. So has this been tarnished for me like some of the NFL?
I'll get the database in order, and then I'll
tell you.
Yeah. So, all right, so Joe, basically what you've come over from the other side of the Atlantic to tell us to pollute one of our great national treasures by making it overly flashy and that the incentive structure would just be totally wrong.
That's what it's already that's what people want to do. That's what fans want to see. That's what players want to do. Why do you have the dunk contest?
And let's say that dunks...
Ridiculous.
You know, you need to produce yourself, Joe. You're off the rails
this
here.
This isn't 1891 or whenever James Naismith invented basketball.
I don't think this would matter that much, actually, because dunks only make up 10% of...
Oh, Neil.
Had to be the buzz.
End the show.
Yeah.
So. End the show.
That'll do it for this. This week's reader mail, Joe Sykes. Thanks for relaying our fans' great ideas.
Thanks, Chad.
All right, that also will do it for this week's show. No Sig Dig this week. Sig Dig will be back soon. Neil, you brought
Chad.
It today. You brought those numbers today.
Thanks.
I thought you were going soft on us, but no, you couldn't. You couldn't.
I talked about feelings, but then I couldn't actually commit to having the feelings. I'll have to work on that. We can psychoanalyze all of us on
we'll
the
have,
show.
We'll have your wife on the show sometime and talk about feelings.
That's not her
numbers.
Specialty.
I know it's not her. I'm about whether feelings and numbers, you know, how they exist in your personal life, I'm saying.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That might be too personal.
That is like way too personal,
yeah.
Chad.
All right.
Come on. Wait until we do our first Mets podcast first.
All right. So our podcast producer is the aforementioned Joe Sykes, who we should mention also hosted, some was intimately involved with a 99% Invisible podcast episode, which really talked about the beauty of the slam dunk and the three-pointer from
a
design perspective.
Wow.
And so
such
bias. That's all we're going to say. So go listen to that and let Joe know that, you know, that's
just, not all about that. The fundamentals,
you got to be transparent about,
watch some
about
Tim
your
Duncan.
Bias. Our podcast, I don't have a good name for him this week.
Guru?
Our podcast guru is Jody Avrigan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow. Our intern is Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcast538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. And Joe would love to hear what you think of that 99% Invisible episode, I'm sure. I'm embarrassing him. He's squinting. He's grimacing. You can find us on Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I am Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.